Good evening and welcome to week five. We are drawing close to the end of this class. And I think it would probably be a good idea for us to start out thinking about what is due this week, what is past due that I haven't turned in yet, and what is due in that last week so that everyone understands how to organize their time and prioritize what is left. To do that, I'm going to go back to the requirements in grading and just take a look at the things that are required in this class. We know that 5% of our grade comes from those practice quizzes that we work on every week. So you will have practice quizzes this week because we are covering our last chapter in the textbook that we use. We don't cover this whole thing, but this is the book, the chapter on probability, chapter 7. So you will have practice questions. I know some of you did get to them on time as you were supposed to before the class meeting tonight. So that's one thing that's due this week that should already have been started. You will have a weekly quiz this week, all right, and it will be over the probability questions in chapter 7. We're finished with discussion forum. That only happens the first 2 weeks. You have a participation grade. Right now, I don't have anybody in this meeting with me, live or online. So if that continues to be the case, then the participation grade will be from watching the recording and submitting your responses online to me. I had two people this past week that submitted responses to me. And I know that recording has been really a struggle because of IT issues here due to power outages. But I think I heard from almost everybody that they had been able to get in and view it. The Spiritual Disciplines Stewardship Journal is 8% of your course grade. Some of you are doing an amazing job with that. Again, there was a recording that went with weeks 2 and 3 and another recording that went with this past week. And so there was a little bit of struggle in some cases with being able to listen to those. So I'm being pretty gracious about deadlines on that, but it is 8% of your grade, and I think it's possibly one of the most valuable pieces in this course. So I hope that you're taking advantage of that and getting that done. Keep in mind, with any late work, whatever aspect of the class it is, the policy is that once it's more than 2 weeks late, you can no longer submit it. So if you have not even started your Spiritual Disciplines Stewardship Journal, then week 1 and week 2 can no longer be done. You've already taken a 0 on those two, and you need to jump in and do the remaining work so that you have something to earn at least part of this 8% from. And then finally, there are the summative grades in this course, all right? For these purposes, these are our major grades. They make up 60% of our course grade. And there are 3 of them. Test number 1 was an open book, short essay question type test. You had some choices. There were 2 that were required. And then you got to choose the remainder of your questions from the list that I provided. I am sad to report this test is now closed. If you have not submitted it, you cannot submit it. And I only have 6 grades. Now, if you submitted that test, not on the course site, but in some other way, for some other reason, I need to hear from you immediately this week. Because I don't know where your test is. I have graded the 6 that were on the course site, and that is all I found to grade. So those of you that, you know, that it's closed, and if you did not do anything previous to this, you know, your top possible grade at this point is 85% because you gave away that 15% by not completing that assignment. The next summative grade that is due, all right, is down here, number 3. It's the portfolio consisting of those 10 short writings. And I've got a list of 15 to 20 things you can choose from. You just need to choose 10. And I'm always hopeful that students are working on this throughout. The discussion board that we did in week 2, you previewed your first one of these. So all you have to do is take the work that you posted on the discussion board, drop it into a Word document, and submit it as your first portfolio entry. So this project must be submitted by the end of week 5. So it will be due a week from today, at the end of week 5. It's late after that, all right? And remember, it cannot be submitted more than 4 days, I think, after the class site closes. So keep that in mind. This is another 15% of your course grade. And it's really very interesting. You do the things that are of interest to you. Nothing requires you to go into great depth. It's intended to be, you know, an interesting and rather fun part of this. You know, much more fun than, say, taking my test next week. And so I hope you're taking advantage of that as well. I hope you're getting started on it. But again, this entire portfolio, all 10 entries, are due at the end of this week. This is week 5. Finally, the third summative grade is worth 30% of the grade, and that is the test that you're going to take next week during this class. Or if you're not taking it during this class, then you're taking it with a proctor, and you must take it on time. We'll go and click on that and look at the time frame for that. I should have already heard from you if you're using a proctor, and I will be contacting your proctor this week to make certain that I can communicate with them and they can receive the document from me and print it all right, because they or see everything. I guess they don't need to print it, but be able to see what they need to see to open and close your test. Your proctor has to be present with you the entire time that you test. They will open the test and they will close the test for you. And to receive credit for that test, they need to have both opened and closed it for you. there are passwords both directions. So please attend to that. That is, you have formula sheets that you may use, and you can use a calculator certainly, but that is not an open book test. So you cannot have your notes out, you cannot have your book open, and if you're taking it and I'm your proctor, then you need to be on the screen at all times. I need to be able to see what you're doing, and you should not be on your phone, you should not be in your book, and the mic needs to be open as well. So keep that in mind when you log in next week. If you come to DCC to be in the room with me for me to proctor that test, then please, if possible, bring a laptop computer, because the test is going to be online on the class site. That's where we will find it. So those are the major grades, and I just wanted to make certain that everyone was aware. If you have missed some practice quizzes, if you have an absence 1 week, you can go back. The practice quizzes remain open, so you can even later earn this 5%. Now the weekly quiz, if you miss that and it's closed, then it's closed unless you have some extenuating circumstances that you have communicated to me. And I said, okay, you know, we'll reopen it. Otherwise, no, you can't get to that. So be aware of those things. Let's make sure we make a strong finish. All right, get the work done. In a 6-week class, we have to build up some information. And so a lot of things do happen here at the end. And I don't want anyone to miss out on something that was significant and that they needed for their grade. All right, so we're on week 5, and it's 6:22. I did not have anyone leave any questions for me to discuss during office hours, so I think I will just go open a practice quiz. And we can just kind of talk about the information that is in there. So practice quiz for last week, week 4. I already had one opened up. So here we go. In a study to determine the most popular automobile on the road, which of the following is the most representative sample? I think we started this quiz last week and we said, it would be the sample of all the cars driving down the highway. If we were to use cars parked at an airport, there's a lot of people that would absolutely never be at the airport. And so it would not include them in our study. Same thing if we talked about a high school. Many, many people never park at the high school. And so that would not be a very good random sample of everybody who does drive a car out on the road. And though I think there's plenty of traffic in front of my house, it probably doesn't represent all the traffic on the road. Which of the following describes a study in which the participants naturally form groups by choice? All right, so that's a case control study, all right, where I choose which one that you go into. Which of the following, usually that's because we went like all the men together and all the women together or something of that nature. Which of the following study results implies that there is a problem with the quality of education at Riddell High? I do remember talking about this last week, so I'm not going to do it. In fact, let me see how far we got on this quiz. Come down here where we haven't already answered them. Let's start with the annual growth rate here. Graph below shows the approximate annual percentage growth rate in world population for the years 1960 through 2010. The data is estimated by the Census Bureau. So 1960 should be right here at the vertical axis. That's the beginning of this data or this study. And then we see 1970, 80, 90. There would be the year 2000, 2010. That's as far as the data goes. And we see that's the end of our graph. So down here to the question, use the graph to answer the question. Discuss the trend in world population during the period between 76 and 78. Well, here's 1970, and here's 1980, and so 76 to 78 would be late, mid to late in that time period. So I would estimate it's right there, all right? And we see that that's a flat line, and so we can say that the growth rate remains constant. It's neither going up nor going down. It was steady all the way through. So I would select answer B as a constant. Use the graph here to answer the question. In this graph, the dark black bar represents 1999, and we're discussing the revenue in millions of dollars. So right here where this is 35, it's not $35, but rather $35 million. And we're looking at the first quarter, second quarter, third quarter, and fourth quarter, or in black, 1999, and in the gray or dotted, the year 2000. In what quarter was the revenue the least for the year 2000? So I am looking for the lowest or shortest bar in the year 2000, so I'm only interested in the gray one. And that would be in the second quarter. So my answer for that would be the second quarter. Make a scatter diagram for the data. The table shows the unemployment rate and the median price of renting an apartment in 9 cities. All right, so unemployment is 2.1%. Median rate for apartment rent is $950. So on and so forth down this table. We're supposed to plot unemployment on the horizontal axis and median rental price on the vertical axis. So my first column is my horizontal. That's pretty traditional. We consider that the x-axis or the independent axis. And then the resulting median rent rate goes on the vertical axis. So I look at this, and I want numbers that are between 2.1 and 7.2 on my horizontal axis. But when I look at my first choice, no, I see those numbers over here in the vertical axis. So this has been graphed incorrectly because they have the information on the wrong axes. So has this one. Again, I see my unemployment on the vertical, but my instruction said put unemployment on the horizontal. So I go down to the third graph. And I see some dots, and here's my unemployment rate, and here's my median rate. So this one at least looks like it's organized right, and so does this one. So now we have to start actually looking at some specific dots in order to be able to tell which of these graphs is the correct one. And I would start looking at where are they different. The first three points seem to be about the same on both of them, but the fourth point on this graph is very low, whereas here the fourth point is kind of in the middle. And so let's see if we can figure out when the unemployment rate is right around 4, maybe 3.9, what does our table say? There's a 3.8. That looks like the closest one. And it says it should be at 650, which is relatively low on these numbers, but let's go look. Here I am at 3.8, and is this at 650? Let's see, 600, 700, 800. So 650 would be between those two. That looks believable. Over here, that looks too high. So I would choose number three. I don't really have to choose, you know, check any further dots. I can if I want to be super careful. But based on the evidence of that difference, I could choose graph three. Number 10, state whether you think the variables have strong positive correlation, weak positive correlation, strong negative correlation, or weak negative correlation, or possibly no correlation at all. So height and body temperature for adults. Well, I was not the best biology student, I would confess, but I believe most adults have a body temperature that hovers around 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, regardless of their height. And so I would say there's no correlation between height and body temperature, and that would be what I would pick for that particular one. So there's just one example of a practice quiz, and we have talked through most of this practice quiz together, and it's now 6:30. So given that I don't have any requests or anyone asking me any particular questions about week four, I am going to go ahead and begin our information for this evening.
How are you along?
I'm doing all right. I told Kyle I had to skip my daughter's choir banquet to be with you tonight, and so if nobody was here with me, I was leaving and gonna go crash the banquet.
Well, darn it.
I know, it's like, you know, y'all, everybody's gonna listen to a recording anyway. Next year's or last year's recording will be just great. You go ahead. But you're here, so now I have somebody to talk with, and I'm much, much happier as a teacher when I have somebody to talk with. Did you ladies have any pressing questions from week four that you wanted me to talk about before we jump into chapter seven?
Not that I can think of.
Okay.
I'm fine.
You're fine. We're all satisfied. Okay, then let's talk about probability. Everywhere, and we are not as good at it as we usually think that we are. It's an interesting thing. Most people would go, oh yeah, I get probability, and then we lose at poker, and then we know that maybe we're not playing our odds quite the way we were supposed to. So, all right, here we go. Considering families of two children, list all the possible outcomes for birth order, okay, of boys and girls. If we are only interested in the total number of boys in the family, then what are the possible events? So this is actually two different questions. One question, we're interested in not only how many boys and girls do we have, but what order they arrived in. In the second question, all we're looking at is the total makeup of the family, and we don't care who's older or when they arrive. So let's look at how that makes a difference. If we are interested in birth order, then we could have a boy followed by another boy, or a boy followed by a girl, or that first one could be a girl followed by a boy, or a girl followed by another girl. These are 1, 2, 3, 4 separate outcomes, because we said that we were interested in order. So these two, VG and GV, are two different ones. In one family, the boy is the oldest. In the second family, the girl is the oldest. So that's a different outcome. Now, if we're interested just in how many boys and girls they have, then it's either zero boys, one boy, or two boys. That's three outcomes. All right, not four, but three. And it would be the same way if we looked at girls. Zero girls, one girl, two girls. Okay, so it's just a choice. The event zero boys consists of a single outcome where you got GG. The event of one boy consists of two outcomes, whether the boy came second or came first. There's two events. And then the event with two boys was the one where we had BB, and there was only one of those. So whereas with order we have four possible outcomes, with just the makeup of the family, there are only three possible outcomes. When we talk about probability, the probability of an event is always going to be somewhere between 0 and 1. All right? If there is zero possibility, that is an impossible event. It cannot happen, no matter what. If the probability is 1, it's a guaranteed or certain event. Now, most of the time, we're not at 0 and we're not at 1. We're somewhere in between, okay? And so our probabilities tend to look like 0.5, 0.25, 0.1, you know, that sort of thing. Kind of like percentages, but in decimal form. A probability of 0, again, is impossible, all right? Cannot happen. A theoretical probability is based on the assumption that every outcome is equally possible. So you just take how many outcomes do you have, divide by how many ways you can get that event, and you get your theoretical probability. Relative frequency probability is based on an experiment or options. Excuse me. And so you're looking, you make an observation and then you write down your data and then you figure it out. I used to teach Algebra 1, and in Algebra 1, our curriculum had a unit on probability. And this was my favorite. We usually did it in the spring, about this time of year. And I would go buy a box of Fruit Loops, and I'd put about a cup of Fruit Loops in each little Ziploc bag. Every kid got their Ziploc bag of Fruit Loops. And they had to sort them by color. And then they had to write down their data, how many red, pink, orange, green, whatever, all comes in Fruit Loops. Did you get how many Fruit Loops total were in your bag? And then they had to calculate the probability if they went and grabbed one Fruit Loop out of the box based upon what they had, you know, what color was it going to be? And this was hilarious. Mostly they just wanted to eat the Fruit Loops and not do the math, but they were pretty enticed to do their math quickly so that they could start eating the Fruit Loops. And then there was the year when I had one poor colorblind kid. I looked at how he had sorted his Fruit Loops, and he had his orange and his green all in one pile together. I happen to have a son who is red-green colorblind. I immediately recognized this behavior, and I quietly said, "Here, let me sort your orange away from your green." He was just like, "Oh, thank you so much." But we were doing an experiment. We were making observations to figure out our probability. A subjective probability is the kind that people often use. It's based on our intuition or what we think or maybe our previous experience. I say things like, here in May, there is about a 25% chance that every student in my class will complete their homework that night. Because it's May, and we're tired of doing homework. And so I'm not getting nearly as good participation in my high school classroom as I did early in the year. Now, that's just my intuition. It's not based on anything else. Okay, so theoretical method for equally likely outcomes. You count the total number of possible outcomes. And then among all your possible outcomes, you count the number of ways to get each outcome. And then you determine the probability by saying the number of ways to have a success, to get what you want, divided by the total number of outcomes that you could get. All right?
So we're going to apply the theoretical method to find the probability of exactly one head when you toss two coins.
Okay, so when I toss two coins, the first coin could be heads, could be tails, right? I've got two possible outcomes. And then the second coin could be heads, could be tails. So when we think about our outcomes for the two coins, it could be that they're both tails. It could be I've got one head and one tail. Or the coins could have been the other way. I have one head and I have one tail, but it was with the other coins. Or I could get two heads. This is exactly like the boy-girl question that we opened with, okay? So coins, children, it works the same way because there's two possibilities. So when they say, what's the probability of getting exactly one head? This is a success. I have one head. This is also a success, one head. So that would be two out of a possible four, and 2/4 reduces to 1/2.
All right.
So there's our first one. The second one is getting a 3 when you roll a 6-sided die. So you got to think about your dice now. You know, you got to go find a dice game and pull out a die if you want to physically look at it. It has 6 numbers on it, 1 through 6. These are my possible outcomes.
So the likelihood or the probability of getting any one of these numbers is 1 out of 6.
Okay? There's one way to get the 1 out of 6 things that I could get. Okay? Success
out of possibilities. That's always how you calculate
probability. Success divided by the possibilities, number of possibilities. All right, then we can start talking about cards. Now, I come from a passionate card-playing family. So I can talk about cards all night with you. But I'll try to hold back. I would love for us just to be able to play some cards and not have to do this class, because that would be very fun. We play Pinochle online with our 2 oldest kids every Friday night. All pretty faithfully. We don't miss very often. Sometimes they go camping and don't have any internet, so then we can't play. But usually we play, so, you know, we like cards at our house. But you've got your 4 suits, hearts, spades, diamonds, clubs, okay? There's an equal number of cards in each suit. Within the suit, you've got the numbers 2 through 10, plus your jack, queen, king, and ace. So you have 13 cards in each suit. Then you can also talk about red cards versus black cards, or as one of our exchange students said, the pretty cards versus the other cards. She cracked us up. She didn't play many cards before coming to our house, so we taught her a lot. If you draw one card at random from a standard deck, what is the probability that it's going to be a spade? Okay. Well, a spade is one suit that you have, okay, and there are 13 spades out of 52 cards. So I could say my probability is 13 out of 52, but they are, of course, because this is a math class, going to reduce that fraction to 1/4. All right? 13 out of 52 is accurate. It's not in our preferred form. Typically, we want you to reduce the fraction if you can. That's what a calculator is good for if you don't like that. So, okay, so here's outcomes and events. Assuming an equal chance of having a boy or a girl at birth, what is the probability of having 2 girls and 2 boys in a family of 4 children? So we kind of have to make a table of our possibilities. What are the possible outcomes? So, you know, we all probably know at least one family that has 4 children and they're all the same sex. My only cousins. Oh, are you one of those children, or does that represent your children, Christine?
We have 4 boys.
You have 4 boys. I can top that. I teach a young man who comes from a family with 5 boys. Not 1 girl, 5 boys. Every time I see his mom, I go, bless your heart. You know, how do you hang in there? They're the best kids ever. But, wow, that's a lot of guys. That's a lot of testosterone in your house. I had cousins that had 4 girls in 5 years. I mean, they not only had 4 girls, but they were really tightly spaced. And I think my uncle only barely survived the teenage years. I really do. So, you know, interesting things happen. But we see that each of those is actually a rather unlikely scenario if we think of it as one possibility out of all of these possibilities. There are six different ways to come up equal, two boys, two girls. Six different ways they can arrive, you know, but you're going to have two boys and two girls. Then there's four different ways that you could get three of a kind. So altogether, we've got 6 and 4 is 10, and 4 was 14, 15, 16. We have 16 possibilities here. And to have Christine's family, there's only a 1 in 16 shot at it, okay? So she is one of the rare and blessed, okay? If you're looking for two girls, okay, two girls, here's two girls, there's two girls, okay, all of those give us two girls. There's six ways to get two girls. And so you have, you know, that's a little better than a 1/3 possibility of having two girls and two boys.
Here we go, relative frequency.
A second way to determine probabilities is to approximate the probability of an event A by making all these observations and counting the number of times that it happens and then looking at it. This is what we call the relative frequency method or the empirical method, or I remember in algebra class we called it the experimental method because I wanted them to remember that if you didn't run an experiment, then you weren't using this, okay? Somebody had to have done an experiment so that you had some data to look at in order to say you were using relative frequency, all right? So if we wanted to, we could, you know, all start tossing coins in here. And I thought about doing it tonight, and then I thought, you know what, I don't think we'll have very good attendance tonight, and I was right. There's fewer of us than there have been. There's a lot going on right now. Hey, Steve's made it in. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
I'm glad you're here. We were short of people for a long time. So anyway, I thought about telling you all bring a coin to class, and then I thought, we'll just use the slides. It'll be good enough, okay? But you can run your own little experiment in which you take two coins and you toss them 100 times, all right? And you write down each time what you get. So I'm tossing my coins over and over, and I'm writing down, okay, I got 0 heads, I got 2 heads, I got 1 head, I got, okay, and I do that 100 times. Here is the data that they suggest for us, okay? Got heads 22 times, 0 heads, 22 times. They came up both tails. Then I got 1 head, so 1 head, 1 tail. I don't care which one's which, just I'm counting them the same way, 1 head, 1 tail. That happened 51 times. And then I actually came up with 2 heads. Both coins were heads, 27 times. And it says, compare these relative frequency probabilities to your theoretical probabilities and decide, do we think these are fair coins? Or do we think that maybe these are not fair coins? So let's look at the math. Theoretical probability says we should get 0 heads 1 out of 4 times. Now, let's make sure we understand where the 1 out of 4 comes from. Okay, that's all right. As long as it lets me write, I don't care.
Doesn't want to let me write. There we go.
Okay, so when I toss my 2 coins?
I could get both heads. I could get 1 head, 1 tail, or the other way around,
1 tail, 1 head.
Or I could get 2 tails. Here are my 4 outcomes.
Out of those 4 outcomes, there's one situation where I have no heads. Here it is, right here. So it happens 1 out of 4 times, 1 out of 4, or 1/4 of the time. Where I get 1 head and 1 tail,
that's these 2, okay? So that's 2 out of 4, which reduces to 1/2.
And then I can get 2 heads, also 1/4 of the time. So there's my theoretical probability. If my coins are fair, and if I throw the dice enough times, I should get results that come pretty close to this. Now, I'm going to go ahead and click through to the next. Now we're going to look at the relative frequencies based upon the data that was in that earlier slide. We had 22 out of 100 tosses, okay, or 0.22, where we got two tails and no heads.
All right, that happened 22
of the 100 times. We got one head 51 times
out of
the 100 tosses. And then we got two heads 27 times. So we look at our data and we go, okay, I would expect to get 0.25, I got 0.22. I would expect to get 0.5, I got 0.51. I would expect to get 0.25, and I got 0.27. And I did it 100 times, which when we get a little further in tonight's lecture and we talk about the law of large numbers, 100 doesn't even hardly count as a large number, okay? That's a relatively small sample space. So these are really extremely close for only 100 tosses. I've certainly seen it come out, you know, less than that. There is definitely no reason to expect that these coins are weighted or suspicious in any way. They are coming out the way we would expect them to. All right, identify the method that resulted in the following statement. So we are thinking about, is this an intuitive statement of probability, okay, just based on experience or intuition? Or is it a theoretical? Or is it based on some kind of an experiment we ran? I'm 100% certain that you'll be happy with this car, says the car salesman when you're out shopping, okay? Upon what basis does he claim his 100% certainty?
On his paycheck?
On his paycheck. He definitely has a vested interest in this. Absolutely. Okay. Or maybe we could say on his salesmanship, but certainly it's some kind of an intuitive thing. It's very subjective. Okay. He doesn't even know you that well, most likely, unless you bought some more cars from him earlier. Then we could maybe start talking about it's an experiment. Based on government data, the chance of dying in an automobile accident during a one-year period is about 1 in 8,000. Now, what kind of a probability are we talking about here? Go ahead, Steve. I know you know. You just look like you know.
I've got the word on the tip of my tongue, but I can't think of it.
Oh, we need to go back and find vocabulary, okay? We ran an experiment, so this is called what kind?
I don't think that would be experiment, would it? Because that's from previous events.
Well, it's an experiment.
We're not going to go out and actually wreck cars. That would be unethical, okay? But we're going to study the data. As long as you have a data set of actual events, it's still considered experimental. So, yeah, you could still call this one experimental. They're going to use a different word here, but I would take either one. It's relative frequency, okay? How often does this tend to happen based upon what we actually see in our data? And then here we go. The probability of rolling a 7 with a 12-sided die is 1/12. Anybody ever seen a 12-sided die?
I've seen one once, just because I have a math teacher friend that has a set of all these unique dice. But I do not own any games with 12-sided dice. But the 12-sided die has a different number, 1 through 12, on each side of it, okay? It kind of looks more like a ball than anything else, but it does have flat sides. So this one, this is theoretical. I mean, you can just look at it and you can say, oh, look, there's only 1 7 on this thing. There's 12 numbers all together, so one chance out of 12. That's theoretical probability. Assuming it's not weighted, that's what I will get. Okay, probability of an event not occurring. Sometimes we are more interested in how often is something not going to happen than we are in how often it is going to happen. There are contexts in which that can be really what you're more interested in. But it is often difficult to calculate an event not happening.
it's usually easier to predict or calculate an event happening. So this is when we go back and we remember that a certain event is worth one. So if I take all of my possibilities, all right, and I add them up, they add up to one. Here, let's just kind of talk about that for a minute. Get rid of that. Okay, so when we were tossing one coin,
the probability of getting it to be, or two coins, I'll do two coins. The probability of getting both heads, there was one way to get that. I could get heads, tails, or tail followed by head. And so there's two ways to get one of each. And then we had one way to get this, okay?
So out of one, two, three, four events, this has a probability of 1/4.
This has a probability of 2/4, which equals 1/2. And this has a probability of 1/4.
If I add 1/4 and 1/4 is 1/2 plus another 1/2, it equals 1. There are no other possibilities, so my probability in a theoretical context has got to add up to 1, all right?
Total probability of all events.
It's a certainty that I'm going to get one of those. Okay, there is no other option that we've forgotten about or we have not considered. So because probabilities add up to be one, as long as you have remembered to consider every possible event, this is one way you can kind of check and know you haven't figured out all the events if your probabilities don't add up to one. So since it's true, then we can use this one subtract the probability that it does happen.
Okay.
So the probability of not throwing two tails, okay, is 1 subtract the probability of throwing two tails, which is 1/4.
And so we would say the probability of not two tails
is going to be 3/4. 1, 2, 3. There are three ways for that to happen. In something as easy as a coin toss, it doesn't really matter which way you calculate it, but in the situation where you've got a lot more options, it's often easier to calculate this way. 1 subtracts the probability that the event actually occurred. All right, they talk about a family of 3 children, having 1 girl and 2 boys. Remember the 1 girl and 2 boys, the probability of that happening is 0.375. So what is the probability of a family of 3 children not having 1 girl and 2 boys? Well, it's going to be 1 subtract the 0.375. Total possibilities are 1. Subtract this 1 result leaves me with the probability of any other result, as long as I don't care about the other result. I just want it to be different than 1 girl and 2 boys. All right, making a probability distribution. Probability distribution represents the probability of all possible events. To make a probability distribution, do the following. List all of your outcomes. Use a table or a figure if it is helpful. Mostly that's just to keep yourself organized, okay? If you're jumping around all over the place, you're going to have trouble knowing when you have figured out all the possibilities. So be a little bit systematic about how you're listing your options. Identify your outcomes that represent the same event, and then determine the probability of each event. Make a table listing each event and its probability. Sum up all of them. They must sum up to be 1. So somebody's missing, or somebody got counted twice, something has gone wrong, if your probabilities do not add up to be 1. I was thinking there was a good one of these, in the textbook. Okay. Here it is. It's on my slide. This is also on page 419 in your textbook. This is looking at the probability when you roll 2 dice.
Okay. So when I roll 2 dice, the
smallest possible number I can get is 2. If I roll snake eyes, I have rolled a 2. The largest possible number I can get is double sixes, which would be 12. So you see, here's one possible way to get 2, and here's one possible way to get 12. Now you see them very systematically listing all the options, okay? And you see that they're very organized about this. Because this table has a lot of entries, and if I'm not organized about it, I'm going to forget one of them. Just guarantee, okay? So I start in my one column, and I say 1 plus 1, 2 plus 1, 3 plus 1, 4 plus 1, 5 plus 1, 6 plus 1, okay? It's very organized. So I can get a 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. All right, so then I start again, and now I'm going to say my second die is 2. So 1 plus 2, 2 plus 2, 3 plus 2, and you see the organization of this table. Okay, so this is what they're talking about when they're talking about a probability distribution. You're listing all of your outcomes, and then you go through and you say, okay, 2. There is only one way to get 2. 1 out of this table has 6 rows, and it has 6 columns. So a 6x6 table has 36 entries in it. So there's a 1 out of 36 possibility of rolling snake eyes. There's a 1 out of 36 possibility of rolling 12. Then we start looking at some other outcomes. There's 2 ways to get 3. 2 plus 1 or 1 plus 2.
When you talk about
4, you can have a 3 and a 1, a 2 and a 2, or a 1 and a 3. So that's 3 possible outcomes of getting 4. And so we see they write it as 3 over 36. Now notice they did not reduce any of these. They left them 1 over 36, 2 over 36, 3 over 36. And I think that's smart. If it was my final answer on a question, I'd probably go ahead and reduce it, though I'm not going to be that picky with you about that. But if my goal is then to add them up and make sure I have 1, I want them to all have the same denominator anyway, so I'm going to leave them in 36, and I'm going to make certain that I have tallied them all up, and I've got 36 over 36, which is 1 when I add them all up, okay? So this is just an example of a probability distribution that is familiar to us, and yet it has quite a few entries, okay? So it really gives us something to talk about, because when you're throwing heads and tails, you don't have that many entries. And if I talked about cards, then that's so many entries that, you know, we don't want to write them all down. Last thing in here is odds. If you talk about gambling, and particularly if you talk about gambling that comes out of Vegas over sports events or something like that, or I think if you go to horse races, though I have to admit I don't care about horse races, and so I'm not too certain other than my experience watching movies, but they talk about the odds on a particular event happening, okay? Odds are related to, but not the same thing as probability. And I think it's important for us to know that. Odds are the ratio of the probability something will occur compared to the probability that it will not occur, okay? So it's not success over possibilities, it's success over failure. Okay, how many ways can I get what I'm after compared to how many ways will I not get what I'm after? Okay? So the odds for an event are the probability that A really does occur compared to the probability that A does not occur. So notice this plus this have got to equal 1. Either A happens or A doesn't happen. Okay? And so altogether, this plus this have to equal 1. And then odds against, you would put not A on top. The possibility of it not being the way I want it compared to the way I do want it. That would be odds against, odds for. In gambling terms, when they say odds on, they usually are talking about odds against.
Okay, so.
Any of you are thinking about taking up gambling, these are things you should know. Otherwise, it might not be real important to you. What are the odds for getting 2 heads in tossing 2 coins? What are the odds against it? Okay, just to make certain, we understand the difference between probability and odds. All right?
I want to be sure.
Clear. Erase that. Okay, so let's first talk about probability.
And then we'll talk about odds. And we're going to look at them side by side so we can see similarities and differences, okay?
What is probability for getting two heads if I'm tossing two coins? Okay, so we've looked at that one several times. There's one way to get two heads out of four possible outcomes, okay? So one out of four or one-fourth is my probability. If instead I'm talking about the odds for getting heads, there's still only one way to get heads. So the top number stays the same. But now it's possible successes over possible failure.
There are three ways that represent
failure for me. If I want two heads, then those two where I've got one of each, they're a failure. The two tails is a failure. And so my odds are one out of three, whereas my probability was one out of four. I think most people walking out on the street just in casual conversation, we use these interchangeably and we're actually wrong. Okay? So again, if you're going to start wagering actual money, make sure you understand the odds thing properly because it may not be what you thought it was. When we talk about what are the odds against something, in probability terms, we would say, what's the probability of not getting two heads? Okay? The probability of not getting two heads. Well, there's three ways
to not get two heads, so that would be three out of four.
Probability.
Not heads. Not two heads.
Sorry. Okay, it's going to be three out of four. But over here, it's going to be
three
over one. Three ways to not get what I want. One way to get what I want. So that would be the odds against it. Does that make sense to everybody? Something?
Yes.
All right. So looking at you, but you're not saying anything. Okay. That's the difference between odds and probability. We need to maybe be more aware of the fact that there is a difference. I'm not sure I knew until I started teaching this class that there really was a difference. Okay, so that's what that slide says, and we are done. We have finished the first section. I'll get rid of those and come down here and find my second one. Now we want to talk about combining probabilities. In that first section, we talked about one event at a time. What's the probability of this one thing happening? What's the probability of this one thing happening? Now we want to up the game a little bit and talk about maybe two or more events. So when we're talking about the probability of more than one event, we need to determine if the events we're looking at are independent or dependent, all right, or overlapping. So two events are independent if the outcome of one has absolutely no effect on the outcome of the other, all right?
They are unrelated
events. They are independent. If two independent events, A and B, have individual probabilities, P of A, P of B, then the probability that both of them occur together, I'm gonna get both things, is one times the other. So we could talk about something like this. What is the probability that I flip a coin and get heads, just one coin, okay, and get heads, and I roll a die and I get a one?
Okay, everybody with me?
What's the probability of me getting both of those things to happen?
On one try.
All right. I think we can do this. We are talking about...
We're going to roll one die. We're going to toss one coin.
Okay? On one roll, I want to know the probability of getting a one. And on one toss of the coin, a coin, I want to know the probability of getting heads. So with my one coin, it's a 50-50 deal. That coin is either going to come up heads or tails, okay? So I have a one-half possibility. There's one success out of two possibilities. Okay? Success over options. One over two. When I roll my die, I have more options. There's six different ways that the die can turn out, and only one of them makes me happy. I want a one. So now it's success out of six possible outcomes, and so the probability of that event is 1/6. Now, if I want to make them both happen at the same time, this is a more difficult event to occur. It is less likely to happen. We need to multiply our probabilities. So I have 1/6
times 1/2.
I realize there's only a 1 out of 12 possibility that I'm on one roll and one toss, I'm going to get exactly what I want.
1 out of 12 times.
That does not mean if I do this 12 times, I'm guaranteed to get it to happen once. It's more like if I do it 1,200 times, I'm guaranteed to get it to happen about 1 out of 12 times. Because it's not going to always occur in a small number of events, but with a large enough event space, you're going to hit this probability. Anybody have a question about that before I move forward?
My dice doesn't have anything
to do with my coin. My coin doesn't have anything to do with my dice. So these are completely independent events. One does not influence the other.
All right. I'm going to erase that.
Click forward a ways here. Okay. Now, you can continue this argument with any number of events. We can talk about three things happening all together, four things happening all together. So I would multiply, I would figure out each individual probability, and then I would multiply them together. So what is the probability of rolling 3 sixes in a row with a single die? So I'm going to roll my die. I want to get a 6.
I'm going to roll it again. I want to play
get a 6. I'm going to roll it again. I want to get a 6. Okay? So now we start talking about things that if you are a game player with dice games, I think of Yahtzee as one that my family has played quite a bit of. There's another one, but we haven't played it in a long time. Right now, I can't think of the name. Anyway, so you start thinking, man, sometimes I do want this to happen. You know? Yes. I wonder what the probabilities really are, you know? And so here we go. Each time, there's a possible 1 out of 6 possibility. Each time I toss that die, there's a 1 out of 6 possibility. But wanting to get it to happen 3 times in a row, 3 successes with no failure. I've got to take 1/6 times 1/6 times 1/6, and it turns out that doesn't happen so often, okay? I think my parents play with my sister and brother-in-law, something called the farming game. They live up in farm country. And when you get ready to harvest, it's all about how well you throw the dice. And they swear that my brother-in-law is luckier than anybody. They still haven't figured out what he does. They don't think he has his own set of dice, but he beats them all the time at the farming game. Okay, probability of dependent events. Sometimes the two events that you want to have happen affect one another. Okay, one impacts the other one occurring. So then we have to calculate our probability of both of them happening differently. Frequently, this is because they overlap. So they talk about what's the probability of getting what you want the first time, and then what's the probability of getting B given that you already got A. All right, this is the way you look at it if you have dependent events. So let's look at some situations like this. Drawing a jury is an excellent example of this, okay? And we've all probably been there and had our opportunity. Will I be chosen? Will I not be chosen? What can I do so they don't choose me? All right. A three-person jury must be selected at random from a pool that has 6 men and 6 women. What is the probability of selecting an all-male jury? Okay, how's that going to happen? We are going on the assumption that they're not considering gender as one of the reasons they're selecting their people. Okay, so it's going to be random. But how often is it going to happen that with an equal pool, men to women, you're going to come out of there with a three-person jury that's all men? So let's look at how this is going to work out. When you draw your first person out, it's 50-50, 6 out of 12, okay? There are 6 men out of 12 possible outcomes. So you've got a probability of 1/2, or 6 out of 12. Now there's only 11 people, though, okay? After that first person is chosen, they can't be chosen again. So now my pool goes down to 11 possible outcomes. Out of those 11, 5 of them are men. So when I choose the second person, there's a 5 out of 11 chance that that's going to be a man. And by the time I do my third draw, I'm down to 10 people and only 4 men, and I have a 4 out of 10 chance. So altogether, first draw, 6 out of 12. 6 men out of 12 possible people. Second draw, now there's only 11 people in the room. And only 5 of them are men. So there's a 5/11 chance of choosing a man there. And then there's only 10 people in the room. And there's a 4 out of 10 chance. So I multiply all those together. I get this nice big fraction, which my calculator will tell me is 0.091. So I have less than a 10th or a 10% chance of getting all 3 jurors to be male. It's not a very likely event.
It's much more likely
there's going to be at least one woman chosen. But you see that it's not 6 12s times 6 12s times 6 12s because every selection decreases my pool. They are dependent events. Once I make that first choice, it changes the probabilities. And so I have to factor that in.
Okay,
so then we have either or probabilities. Two events are non-overlapping if they cannot occur together. So when I'm tossing dice, I can get a heads or I can get a tails, but I can't get both, okay? Those are independent. Non-overlapping events are easier. You just add them together. First I got this, then I got this. Because there's no overlap. So suppose you roll a single die, what's the probability of rolling either a 2 or a 3? Well, my probability of rolling 2 is how much? Let's have a shout out from somebody in the crowd.
1 in 6.
1 in 6. So I've got a 1 in 6 possibility of rolling a 2. Is my probability of rolling a 3 affected by this? Yeah, it's still 1/6. So I've got 1/6 plus 1/6 is 2/6. Okay? The probability of rolling a 2 or a 3, in essence, there's 2 ways to succeed out of 6 possibilities. Because I'm happy if I get a 2. I'm equally happy if I get a 3. So I have 2 successes out of 6 possibilities. All right? I just add them up because there's no overlap. So I don't have to worry about counting something twice. Now we start talking cards. Two events are overlapping if they occur together. And we see our old friend, the Venn diagram, makes a comeback, okay? We talked about Venn diagrams, I think, in week one. I believe it was week one. And just when you thought it was never going to happen to you again, they have turned back up in class. They're a really nice way in probability to look for, do these two events overlap? Do they have anything in common? Because if they do, then I've got to think about that when I'm calculating probabilities, okay? So what are we looking at here? What is the probability of picking a queen or a club? Okay? So in a deck of cards, there are 4 queens, 1 of each suit. So I see a possibility of 4. And remember, my deck has 52 cards altogether. So the probability in the blue circle here is 4 out of 52. 4 over 52. What's the probability that I'm going to select a club with that first card that I select out? Well, remember, there are 13 of each suit. So there are 13 clubs in there. One of them is the queen, okay? So now when I just talk about what's the probability of drawing a club, I'm going to write 13 out of 52. But this queen got counted twice. Everybody see that? The queen got counted twice. So that's not good. That's going to mess up my calculation. It's not going to be as accurate. So I have to allow for that. Probability of the first event plus the probability of the second event subtract the probability of both of those things happening. There is a one chance of them both happening. All right? And go back. They finish that. And then they say you can have more and more events. Okay, that's fine. What's the probability in a standard shuffle deck of cards you will draw a five or a spade? And so we look at it. This is an overlapping event. My five could be a spade. All right? So I don't want to count it twice. So probability of drawing a five is going to be 4 out of 52. The probability of drawing a spade is 13 out of 52. And then we've got to subtract out that one that we're counting twice. So that one that we counted twice comes out 1 out of 52. There is only one deck or one card in the deck that is both a 5 and a spade. So the possibility or probability of getting both of these events to happen is 1 out of 52. That's what I subtract back out so that it doesn't get counted twice. So 4 plus 13 is 17, minus 1 is 16. I've got a 16 over 52 or 4 13ths chance
of drawing a 5 or a spade or the other.
Okay, so these are events that depend on one another or are overlapping. And then the at least once rule for independent events. Suppose the probability of an event A occurring in one trial is the probability of A, and all trials are independent, okay, so they're not affecting one another at all. Then what is the probability that event A occurs at least once in N trials? Okay, so I'm going to do whatever it is I'm going to do over and over again, N times. And I want to know what's the probability that at least once I'm going to get what I want. Well, this is one of those, sometimes it's easier to find the probability of it not happening at all and then subtracting, okay? Notice that my number of trials becomes an exponent. Okay, notice that in this formula. Again, this is going to be on a formula sheet. You don't have to memorize this formula. Just need to recognize when I'm going to need it. Okay? So here's the use at least once rule. One head when I'm tossing three coins. Okay? So because I have three coins, my N is 3. It would be the same thing if I had one coin and I was going to throw it 3 times. Okay, it would work the same way. The at least once rule says the probability of at least one head in 3 tosses, okay, is 1 subtract the probability of no heads in 3 tosses. So to get no heads in 3 tosses, I would have to have tails, tails, or am I throwing one coin or two? Okay, 3 coins. So I'd have to have tails each time, all right? And I'm going to do it 3 times. So there's a 50-50 chance, 1 half of getting tails, times 1 half times 1 half. That is 1 eighth. 1 minus 1 eighth. There's a 7 eighths chance that you're going to get at least one head. And if you think about that, you're thinking, if I throw the coin 3 times, surely heads is going to come up once. You can't believe it if there's tails 3 times in a row. You know, we don't expect that to happen. Because there's only like a 1/8 chance of that happening.
All right.
It won't happen real often, but yeah, it can happen. So then, here is our country's favorite way of throwing money away. Gambling, okay? Let's buy some lottery tickets and see what kind of a good investment this is. So you purchase 10 lottery tickets. The probability of winning some prize, we don't care how big, okay? I'm just going to win something. Maybe all I do is win the $1 that I spent on the ticket. It's still a win, all right? What is the probability? Okay, so I have a 1 in 10 chance of winning something. What is the probability that you will have at least one winning ticket among your 10 tickets? So this is an at least one. 1 minus the 1 tenth possibility of not winning, okay? Is 9/10 chance. Okay, the probability of winning with any one ticket is 1/10. So the probability of not winning with any one ticket is 0.9. Okay, so far, so 9 out of 10 times I'm likely not to win. And that's the one that's going being raised to the 10th power. Okay, so 1 subtract this number is approximately 0.65 or about 65% of the time. There we go. We shall exit that as well. Okay, let's take a break from these slides and let's actually think about some problems from the book, okay? The kind of things that you're liable to be asked, okay, on your quiz. Make sure that we can actually do this. I'll get that out of the way. Give myself a whiteboard, okay? Let's go back a minute to 7A. So I am looking at question 24, and I will find a page number for you here. Question 24 is on page 422. And in it, we're asked to figure out, use the theoretical method to determine the probability of the following outcomes and events, and state any assumptions that you make. All right. So question 24 says, randomly selecting a three-child family that has exactly two girls. Okay, a three-child family with exactly two girls. So to start talking about this, we need to lay out our table of possibilities and see if we can figure out how many options are there really for how three children can arrive on the scene. So let's start. The book always starts with the guys first, so I'm going to be different and start with the girls. Let's say that you've got three girls. One possible outcome of a family of three is that they have a girl followed by another girl followed by another girl. Now, they could have a girl followed by a boy, followed by another girl. They could have a boy followed by a girl, followed by another girl. Or they could have two girls and then a boy.
Are we supposed to see this?
Yes, are you not seeing it?
No, ma'am.
That is very unfortunate. Okay. Thank you for saying something. I'm working for myself. Okay, do you see my class screen?
Yes.
Okay. I'll try writing on it. I don't know why it's not letting you see the whiteboard, but I'll just work here. I can work with this. So here we go again. Our family can have three girls in a row. There we go. Or they could have a girl
followed by a boy, followed by another girl. Or they could have two girls followed by a boy. Or they could have started with a boy and then
had two girls. So here we have three girls. Here we have two girls. Can you think of any other ways for us to have two girls? Have I covered them all or did I miss something? Girl, boy, girl. I think I'm good. Do you agree?
I think so.
Okay,
so this is three girls. This is two girls.
Now let's talk about one girl.
Okay, so if we're going to have one girl,
she may be the first to arrive, followed by two boys. Okay, or I could have a boy, then have a girl, and have another boy. Or you could be like the Long family. Two boys, and then that beloved girl comes along last. Don't think she's not a princess in every way. Oh my goodness, what a blessed life. Okay, so there's the possibilities for one girl. Now, we could have no girls at all.
Christine knows this to be true.
So there's my three boys, and the girl does not turn up. Would you agree that we have now figured out our event space? We have all the possibilities for a family with three children. Everybody like it? No one's arguing against it. All right. Now, what if we randomly select a family, what's the probability that they're going to have exactly two girls? Well, here's my two girls. There's three ways to get two girls. Okay, three possibilities. So three possibilities of success out of how many different family types can I choose from? Well, here's three, that's six, seven, eight. So I would say we have a 3/8 possibility or probability
of selecting
a family with two girls if we're selecting from three child families. This is our theoretical probability. What assumptions did we make? We made the assumption that these children were equally probable. The girls and guys are, arrive with equal probability. Okay, we treated it as a one-half even each time. Any questions about that problem, doing that problem?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so
we're going to erase that one. How about number 30? I'm on the same page, okay? So we're still working from question or page 422. And now we're going to look at question 30. It's a slightly different question. Halfway through the season, a basketball player has hit 36 free throws in 50 attempts.
Okay.
So we have some data on this person. We know what kind of shooter. Based on her performance to date, what is the relative frequency that her next free throw will be a success? So based upon her previous performance,
she's hit
36 out of 50, so we expect her to behave in the same way. Based on the data, we would say there's a
36 out of 50, or divide that into 118 out of 25
chance that she's going to make that shot.
All right.
I'm just using the data that I already have, the statistics that she has earned this far. This is what announcers are looking at when a certain player comes up to the free throw line and they either say, I have no idea why that team fouled that person, or they say they got the person they wanted, okay? Because the opposition wants to put somebody on the free throw line that doesn't hit very often. They don't want to put the team's best free throw shooter at the line. And so especially in a really close game at the end where you see a lot of fouling, just trying to get the ball back, you're trying to be a little bit careful about who you foul. This person has this kind of a percentage going for them,
all right,
based upon how they've been shooting. That's what we would expect. So that's relative frequency. You're just figuring that they're going to do what they usually do.
Which numbers did you divide?
What numbers did I divide? The 36 successes.
Okay, because they're asking me
that how likely is it she's going to make the next one? So possible successes. She's made 36
out of 50 attempts.
So this is 36 is my success, 50 is my attempt. I divide those two. I'm trying to think. I didn't put it in my notes, but you could
pick up your calculator and figure out your decimal
value for that, or double 36. 72. She's a 72%
yes.
shooter. Okay.
So thank you.
72% chance that she's going to hit that next shot. Are we okay with that one?
Yes.
All right. And then 38. Let's look at question 38. I selected one more from this group. The probability of an event not occurring. Okay. Let's kind of look at it from that negative point of view. An event not occurring. All right, so in question 38, what is the probability that the next person you meet was not born in July?
We're assuming there's 365 days in a year. Let's see.
Determine the probability of the following events, stating any substance that you make. Okay, so what do you want to guess about,
what do we want to assume
about the month that you are born in? Are we going to assume that every month is equally possible, or do you believe more babies show up at certain times of year? I'm a big fan of equally possible. It makes a lot easier problem, but anybody want to weigh in?
I think equally is good.
Equals good? Okay. So we're going to assume that it's equally possible that you're born in any month of the year, on any particular day of the year. Okay? That there is no one day. If you watch the Super Bowl, they always they started doing this thing in the last couple of years where they go to the city that wins the Super Bowl and they check out their birth rates 9 months later compared to the previous year, and it's always higher because apparently part of the celebration is creating babies. And so they can actually show that statistically in cities the birth rate goes up. But we're going to ignore the fact that I know that little factor, and we're just going to say it's equally possible on any day of the year. So looking at this question, what's the probability that the next person you meet was not born in July? Well, let's first think about the probability of being born in July, okay? So what's the probability that your birthday
is in July? Well, your birthday could be any one of the 365 days of the year.
So in terms of my possible outcomes, there are 365 of them. May have been born on any day of the year. All right, then, what's the probability that you were born in July? Well, how many days are there in July?
31.
31. July is one of those 31 months. So there is 31
successes
for me if I am hoping that you were born in July. Then I view those 31 days as a success, and I view all other days as failure, okay? So this would be the probability that you were born in July. So if I want the probability that you were not born in July, I just do
1 minus this, okay? And I can think of this 1 as being 365 over 365.
Okay. And so when I'm subtracting my fractions,
my denominator is still going to be 365,
but now I need to subtract this.
And I'm going to get 3, 3, 4.
So the likelihood that a random person that I grab on the street is not born in July is pretty high, okay? Because July is only one of 12 possible months. And so it's really much more likely that they were not born in July than that they were born in July.
Anybody have
questions about that one? All right, then let's move forward. I think I also grabbed a couple of questions, well, several questions it looks like, from section B. We've already looked at the slides for B, so let's go ahead and look at the questions for B as well. These begin on page 434. All right, so on page 434, let's start out by looking at question 16. Our directions say in this section, and these are and probabilities. Determine whether the following events are independent or dependent, and then find the probability of the event. All right, now I want to draw your attention because I'm betting that just because we flipped through the slides one time, you have not memorized all those lovely little formulas. I haven't either, just in case you were wondering. So back at the end of the chapter, on page 469, there's our formula sheet, okay? So go look at the formulas.
On page 469.
I don't expect you to pull these out of thin air, and I don't want you to waste time and brain power memorizing them this week. We're just going to look at these, and they're going to help us figure out what we need to do. All right? So we are considering, I actually want to look at question 24. I think that's the one I said, isn't it? No, I'm sorry. Yeah, it is. 24. Where they give us this set of instructions. Drawing either a jack or a spade from a regular deck of cards. So what is the probability
that I draw a jack
or a spade? And if I could draw a spade, I would, but
alas,
I can't draw anything, so I have to write it out. A jack or a spade. Are these independent events or overlapping events?
They're overlapping.
My jack could be a spade. It might not be, but it could be. Okay? So, it is an overlapping event. So, I've got to look at my formula that says either or, because that's what I'm asked, a jack or a spade, with overlapping events. And so, in that second box that's kind of pinker than the first box, one, two, three. The fourth one listed is the one that says, here's your formula for either or probability with overlapping events. I need to know each of the probabilities. I'm going to add them together, and then I'm going to subtract out the overlap. So I need to calculate the probability that I get a jack. I'm going to add to that the probability that I get a spade.
And then I'm going to subtract
from that the probability
that I get
the jack of spades, the overlapping event, okay? That's what my formula tells me to do. That's what I'm going to do in this situation, all right? So the probability of getting the jack. In my deck of cards, there are four jacks,
and there are 52 cards.
So I've got a 4 out of 52 possibility of drawing a jack. There's the first probability. I add to that my second probability, spades. That's one of four suits, okay? So there are 13 spades out of the 52. It's one in four, but I'm keeping my denominators the same. So 13 over 52 will work great for this. And then I need to subtract out the possibility that the card that I pick
is the jack of spades.
Well, there's only one jack of spades.
And so I've got a
1 out of 52 chance of drawing that jack of spades out. That's what I have to subtract out because it is my overlap event. So I have 17 successes. 4 plus 13 is 17 minus 1.
My final answer is 16 out of 52.
And I could reduce that by 4 and have 4 13ths, okay, for my answer for that way. Or you can put it in fraction form and your calculator would tell you it's 0.308. All right, anything at all that we need to spend more time on there? If not, let's move to number 62, which requires us to turn the page. Now we're on page 436. Let's look at a lottery question, okay? Question number 62, lottery odds.
Okay, number 62.
See what we can make out of this. The probability of a $2 winner in a particular state lottery is 1 in 10. The probability of a $5 winner is 1 in 50. And the probability of a $10 winner is 1 in 500. So these are the stated odds. Lotteries always publish. They are required by law to publish. What is the odds of winning each particular amount that they're giving out? So these are the stated odds or the stated probabilities for this particular game. All right? So then we're asked to calculate, what is the probability of getting either a $2 or a $5 or a $10 winner? And we're going to compare that against the probability of getting only a $2 winner. Okay? So we're going to get, we're looking at one ticket, going to go buy a ticket, and I want to know what is the probability that I'm going to get either. Okay? So I'm going to be happy if I win $2, $5, or $10. There's three types of success there for me. Okay? And each of them comes with its own probability. Now, can my single ticket, okay, this one lottery ticket that I bought, can it be both a $2 and a $5 winner?
No.
It wins one prize, that's it, okay? So is this an independent or is this an overlapping event that we're looking at?
It's independent.
It's independent. My ticket is either a $2 winner, a $5 winner, okay, or a, whatever they said, a $10 winner, okay? So the first part of this is to calculate the probability of being either a $2, a $5, or a $10 winner. That is an independent event, and so according to my chart, again, I'm back on page 469, looking at my chart, I want you to understand how to use your chart. It's no good to you if it doesn't make sense to you. It says, if we have non-overlapping events, then all we do is sum up our probabilities, P of A plus P of B. Everybody see where I am? We're still in section 7B, so we're in that kind of pinkish block, and it's the third one down. So I've got three possibilities here, so I'm going to sum up my three probabilities, and my three probabilities...
Probability of those three winners, $2 or $5 or $10, okay?
That probability is 1/10,
1/50, and 1 out of 500.
So my total probability of getting one or the other is the sum of those three fractions, all right? So I put it into my calculator, what's 1/10 plus 1/50 plus 1/500, and I find out that this is equal to 61/500,
or it is
more likely that your calculator is going to say it's
0.122.
Usually, the calculator puts your answers in decimal form. That's its default mode. All right. So I see that I have a 0.122 possibility of having either a $2 winner, a $5 winner, or a $10 winner. I'm happy if I win any one of those, so that's three different ways to get success. We're supposed to then compare to the probability of getting only a $2 winner. Well, they stated in the problem that the probability of getting a $2 winner was 1 in 10. So the probability
of $2 was stated as 1 in 10 or 0.1. And I see that if I want to take
in three possibilities, I've got a little more chance of winning, okay? My percentage or probability of having a winning ticket is a little bit higher if I'm going to be happy with $2 or $5 or $10 than it is if I'm only going to be happy with $2. Don't know why I would feel that way anyway, but there you go. You see how it works out. So then, part B, if you win 50 lottery tickets, what is the probability that you will get at least one $5 winner? Okay, at least one $5 winner. Okay, my $5 winner was a 1 in 50, right? The probability is 1 in 50. So my formula for at least one, let's reference this, at least one event in A in trials is 1 minus P
of no events in trials. Okay, so I am going to have this part B. Oh, terrible looking B. There we go. I'm going to have 1 subtract. There are 49 out of 50 chances to fail, according to the probabilities stated here. Okay, I only have a 1 in 50 chance of getting a winning ticket if I want to win at that level. And then I have to raise this. Didn't they tell me 50 tickets? So then I raise that to the power of 50. Okay, 1 subtract, 49/50 is raised to the power of 50. Now you got to make sure you use your exponent key when you're plugging this into your calculator. 50 is an exponent. 50, we're not multiplying this times 50. We're raising it to the power of 50. So make sure you use your exponent key when you enter that into your calculator. You should find out that this is equal to 0.64. Or at least approximately 0.64.
Okay. So you have about a 64% chance in your 50 tickets to have at least one $5 winner.
At least one.
And then it says if you buy 500 lottery tickets, what's the probability that you will get at least one $10 winner? Okay, so it's going to be the same formula. I'm going to have 1 minus, but this changes because we moved from a $5 ticket to a $10 ticket. So the $10 ticket has a 1 in 500 chance of being a winner, which means I've got,
if I can squeeze it on here,
499 ways to not have a winner.
And I am going to raise that to the
power of 500, okay? Power of 500. Okay, so when I plug that into my calculator, I get actually a slightly lower possibility. This one is 0.63.
Now, what I
want to point out about this, my last one in this section,
is that most people, I believe, again, if we just talk about the average person on the street, what is their intuitive understanding of probability? They would say, if something has a probability of happening 1 out of 500 times, I'm going to get a ticket that's worth $20 on average 1 out of 500 times. Then they would believe that if they bought 500 tickets, it was pretty much a guarantee that they were going to have a $20 ticket in there. Because it's 1 out of 500
and I bought 500. When we do the math, we see that that is not true at all. I really only have slightly more than a 50-50 chance of having a $20 ticket in there. All right? So what our intuition feels about probability is most of the time different than how probability actually calculates out. And most people would overestimate their understanding of probability and would guess wrong more often than they would guess right. It's one of those things that just goes against our natural number sense. And we have to really look at the calculations, really list out those possibilities and think about what's going on to really have a good solid grasp of how the calculations go. So I would really strongly discourage you when you're doing your questions this week, don't go with your gut. There's a lot of times when going with your gut is not a bad idea, but with probabilities, it's probably a bad idea. I wouldn't recommend it. All right, it's 8 o'clock. Let's take a 15-minute break. We'll see you all back at 8:15. Thank you.